On this week's 51%, we speak with a woman who launched an airbrush-free women's magazine.
Photograph women as they really are and not in an aesthetically predetermined way.
We meet a woman who helps crow children connect with their heritage, and a female scientist fills us in on a cat parasite that could be especially harmful to women who are pregnant. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. You don't have to try. 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 Take your makeup off, let your hair down, take a breath, look into the mirror at yourself, don't you like you? Before we get into our first interview, I'd like to point out that the bit of song you just heard, Try, by Colby Calais, has an accompanying video that shows the singer all made up, and by the end of the video, she removes her makeup, faux lashes, and all of that to reveal, well, herself. There are several other women in the video, too, of various shapes, sizes, and ages, who do the same. And this is a relevant lead-in to our first piece. Enchantress Magazine is a new destination for millennial women. It's airbrush-free, and you won't find any beauty tips among the pages. The inaugural issue was launched earlier this year and features New York City's women firefighters. It also contains a Q&A with six accomplished women who discuss the biggest problem facing American millennial women today and, more importantly, how do we start solving it? And there's lots more. Chloe Kent is the magazine's writer and editor-in-chief. She writes, quote, "To speak metaphorically for a moment, if GQ is a leather Chesterfield sofa and Vogue the set of porcelain elephant end tables in Joan Didion's living room, Enchantress is an IKEA armchair, not because we're cheap or made in Sweden, but because we're something you can really get comfortable with. We'd like to think we aren't aspirational, but inspirational. We're relatable," end quote. I asked her the genesis of Enchantress.
As an entertainment writer, I was and am bothered by a lot of the ways stories were being told. I wasn't into gotcha journalism. I wasn't into sensationalizing really trivial details about a famous person's life. And so even in journalism school, I started daydreaming about the publication I really wanted to create as a direct reaction to that. And I started by ripping apart all the things I was taught about magazines that I didn't like. I mean, as a result, we've taken away airbrushing and, Enchantress has nothing to do with fashion or beauty or celebrities or fitness, even though it is a women's magazine. And instead, we feature amazing women, none of whom are celebrities, and amazing stories on our cover, none of which involve cover lines like 12 exercises to lose your muffin top or something. You know, we don't even do cover lines. Instead, we do things that are more inspirational than aspirational.
What has been the response?
So the firefighters were, I hope, happy with the way that the cover story turned out. And we got a lot of really inspiring messages from our readers on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram saying how they'd never imagined that a women's magazine could feel like that.
I mean, you have this goal, you have this vision, and then you get feedback that kind of supports that vision. And how does that make you feel?
I mean, honestly, it's just incredible to me that I took something that that was just an idea that I'd never even said the word Enchantress out loud to anyone for the first couple months that I was working on this. So it's amazing to me that people even know what the word Enchantress means to me, because it was an idea that I just held on to for so long, just as like a little kernel of an idea.
You know, I know what the word means, but I have to say, when you hear the word Enchantress, this is not the magazine you think you're going to get.
Right. I mean, I guess in the sense that it's not a traditional women's magazine and it's not exactly a literary magazine either. It's sort of a hybrid of the two that's targeted towards women and women's issues. But actually what's interesting to me is that the word Enchantress, when we went to trademark it, is mostly used for like lingerie and perfume and stuff. It's very like old school French or something. Yeah, I definitely understand where you're coming from.
So tell me about this airbrush-free universe and in this fire issue.
Sure. So we use Polaroids instead of traditional digital photography because most of what we do is about documenting as opposed to creating a narrative. So in journalism school, I was always taught that when it comes to photography, there are mirrors and there are windows. Mirrors capture moments as they are, and windows sort of reimagine worlds as they could be, as they might be. So my aim with making the magazine entirely Polaroid-based and devoid of any airbrushing is to photograph women as they really are and not in an aesthetically predetermined way, which goes along with the fact that the magazine is entirely nonfiction women's stories, from interviews to photo essays, personal essays, graphic memoir. And we wanted to use the women firefighters as our cover women because they represent something so powerful and incredible when you hear just their stories. Most New Yorkers don't even realize that there are now 52 women firefighters in the FDNY out of a roughly 10,800 person force, which is about 0.04%. And so we wanted to depict these women in a way that was at once powerful, but also not really, not too cerebral in its design. There isn't a lot of zhuzh going on, for lack of a better word. It's really, these photos, when you look at the cover, really present these women as they were exactly in that moment, with no airbrushing and no elaborate lighting setup or anything like that.
Chloe, how will you measure success?
Well, it's hard to define. I think success for me would be to continue to put out issues and to grow the community of women so that our readership really comes to life and that we're sort of accomplishing the ideals of the magazine, IRL, as they say. So in bringing about this event series, we hope that just like the goal of our magazine is to commiserate and celebrate together, we hope that our readers come together and celebrate, commiserate, and drink wine, you know, together as one does. And I think just publishing regular issues, to me, it doesn't matter about social media metrics or anything like that, although, you know, I realize that that's like probably the number one factor in mainstream magazines, given that, you know, that's the bottom line. But really, for me, it's about creating a community.
So let's talk about advertising. How do you sustain this?
Well, it's very difficult, as you know. We hope to sustain it through advertising in our first print issue and through advertising on the site, as we did before when we were a blog, and through events and through revenue, like I said, online. So, I mean, it is very tough, but we're lucky that we've built a small niche community that continues to grow.
So will you be picky about who advertises with you?
I mean, obviously we need to be because a lot of advertisers don't present their content in a means that would strike our fancy. I mean, I don't think that we would be okay with putting any sort of airbrush photographs in the magazine, even if it was advertised. So it's definitely a different way to think about how to advertise. But obviously, everything that we've done thus far has been really in line with our goal. Everything from branding to who I hire. I mean, we are an all-women team. So everything has been in line so far, my team and I would never veer off course just to bring in more advertisers.
Have you had to turn anyone down?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's definitely been a ton of people on social media of brands that wanted to advertise things that we couldn't be involved in. It's more important to me to connect with the reader than it is to sell them anything. My background is in writing. So in my mind, at the end of the day, the most important thing to me is the writing. But yeah, we've definitely had like a bunch of like, you know, like jewelry brands and things like that, like ask for mentions on Instagram, you know, regular mentions or whatever, but we don't do that. I never want to get in the way of our readership. I feel like there's such a level of trust there with our audience.
So what do you envision next for possibly another issue?
Well, we have a list of about 100 different topics that we're thinking of for the cover. So for this issue, it was centered around the idea of fire. And then we put 4 women who are in FDNY on our cover. And so for the next issue, we kind of want to go in a much different direction. It's going to be a surprise. We are down to like maybe like the final 3 contenders, but we won't announce it until later in the year, as soon as the issue comes out or shortly before. But my hope is that we continue to feature ordinary women who are doing extraordinary things.
So tell us more about the women firefighters in New York City.
Like I mentioned, there are now 52 women firefighters, and they make up 0.04%. And it's still 0.04%. I mean, it's infinitesimal, even in comparison to almost any other male-dominated industry. So there's actually, I mentioned it in the cover story that I wrote for our first issue, there's actually slightly more billionaires in New York City than there are women firefighters, which is pretty amazing to me considering how diverse the city is as a whole and how diverse most other fire departments across the country are. So even though the FDNY goes back to the 1600s, when firefighters who were volunteering, this was even before the FDNY, would bring just buckets of water to the scene of fires. But the first women firefighters wouldn't be sworn in until 1982, when Brenda Berkman, who's featured in the story, successfully won a class action lawsuit against the city of New York. And in the 34 years that women have been in the FDNY, they've achieved a lot of well-deserved success, but they've also faced just incredible opposition, and they've endured a level of harassment and ostracism that seems almost unthinkable now. There were protests outside City Hall. There were death threats. There were bumper stickers plastered all around the city that said things like, "Don't send a girl to do a man's job." And that was just the public, let alone everything that went on inside the firehouses. So fortunately, it does seem like the FDNY is making a lot of changes in terms of how people are hired and recruited. I think that ultimately the history of these women really got swept under the rug. And so that's why I really, really wanted to cover this story and why it took me so long to do so. I kind of just spent between 6 months and a year on this story, going all over New York City, just looking to get a grasp on what it was like to start out in those early years and what it's like to be a woman firefighter in the FDNY now. I think before, the women had been hesitant to speak about their experience publicly because they were afraid of inviting harassment or discouraging future classes of women from entering the department. But it was an incredible experience to speak to these women firefighters. I mean, and then not only that, but to go visit them at their firehouse. I went to a training camp with them on Randall's Island for a day. And the whole experience, it was incredible. I mean, I'm so lucky that that I'm able to do things like that because of long-form journalism.
Apart from the low numbers you mentioned, what really sticks with you from covering this story? What's fresh in your mind?
I think for me personally, there's one quote that stands out for me, and that's from Brenda Berkman, who is incredible. I mean, she has her own like Makers episode, and she's the subject of a documentary, PBS documentary that's narrated by Susan Sarandon, and she's incredible. And she said, I've been like sort of intimidated by her, and I sat down with her and I asked her point blank, why it was so difficult for so many years for you to do this. Why did you keep going? And she said, I'm paraphrasing, I'm going to butcher this quote. She said, all throughout my life, I've been told that I couldn't do the things I wanted to do because I was female. I was told that I couldn't play baseball because girls played softball. I was told that I couldn't take higher level math classes because girls should study English. I was told that girls couldn't run for student council president. And by the time that I got to the FDNY, I thought there's no way I'm letting anyone stop me from doing this just because I'm female. And that really stuck with me.
That was Chloe Kent, writer and editor-in-chief of Enchantress magazine. The first issue, Fire, can be found at enchantressmag.com. As a child on Montana's Crow Reservation, Peggy White, well-known Buffalo, was taken from her home, put on a bus, the first she'd ever seen, and sent to a Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding school out of state. She was punished for speaking her language and for following traditional Crow spiritual practices. The experience, as it was for most Native kids, was a traumatic one. As an adult, Peggy has dedicated her life to helping Crow children connect with their history, culture, language, and place.
You're listening to Mountain West Voices. I'm Clay Scott. I was driving through the Crow Reservation in southeastern Montana on a cold, gray day with a hard rain that wouldn't let up, and I noticed an unusual-looking cluster of buildings surrounded by cottonwood trees. I parked by a locked gate where a hand-painted sign read, "Well-known Buffalo Center, empowering youth to promote a just future." A spindly-legged foal took shelter on the porch of a house, and a couple of dogs watched me. It was raining too hard to get out of the car, but I was too curious to leave. After a few minutes, a woman emerged from the house without a raincoat. She didn't seem at all surprised to see me, and we went inside to talk.
My name is Peggy White, well-known Buffalo. That's my white English name. My Indian name is Balasashilish, meaning one who has abundance. I live here in Garryowen, Montana, and I live at the foothills of where the Battle of the Little Bighorn took place. This is my my family's allotted land. Where I built my home is where the Sioux and Cheyenne children hid and mothers hid while the Battle of the Little Bighorn was going on. I was raised on a reservation. I believe in the Crow Way. My life is the Crow Way. I was sent to an Indian boarding school in South Dakota called Peer Indian School. And it was in the 60s. I was very young. And my mother had eight kids. And through the eight kids, my mother had to select half of them to go to a boarding school, and she could keep the other half. She had to give my father's allotted land to the state of Montana to support the other four. So my mother chose me. And when I got there, I was also scared. And I was also told not to speak Crow, my Crow language, Apsalugo language. And there was a lot of Crow kids that were taken. And a bus came and picked us up. And I never rode in a bus before. I had to work, clean things. They started me as cleaning. I was younger, so they had me go to the little girls and little boys' dorm, which were young kids, babies, and toddlers, to go and clean them up. But I always went, I held them, and they would just hold on to me. And some of them were very thin. But I held them, and I'd pray, and I'd sing to them. But, you know, I was singing my lullaby songs in Crow, and no one got mad at me. I went there just to speak my language to these kids that, because I couldn't do it anywhere else. So I'd talk to them in Crow, and I'll sing lullabies, and hold them, carry them, clean them, and every time I work on a child, it's what you call a massage in your Western ways, but in a traditional Crow way, we call it Bapajila, Bagadhoase, the one who treats children, the one who takes care of children. And that's what I do.
You've been listening to Peggy White, well-known Buffalo. Mountain West Voices is produced in association with the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West, a regional studies and public education program of the University of Montana. Additional support was provided by the Greater Montana Foundation. To listen to and download more stories from around the Rocky Mountain West, go to mountainwestnews.org. I'm Clay Scott.
Cat lovers know that their feline friends carry a certain risk, and it's not the danger of snag sweaters. One Virginia scientist says the notorious cat-loving parasite Toxoplasma can infect humans. But cats aren't the only things exposing us to this brain-altering parasite. Lilia Fukin has more.
A few years ago, studies came out warning people against the dangers of a parasite that's carried by cats and could infect human brains. Emily Lilly, a biologist at Virginia Military Institute, says the weirdest part about the news was that in rodents, Toxoplasma parasites would sort of hijack the brain and make the rodents attracted to cats.
In cats, it doesn't cause disease. Cats are what's known as the definitive host, meaning that for this organism to complete its life cycle, it has to get to a cat. So everything it does in anybody else that it infects, whether it's a mouse or a rat or a human being, is all about, can I get back to the cat?
Let's look at how many cats actually carry Toxoplasma. The traditional way of testing is to check cat feces for the parasite's oocysts, or zygote stage. It's been commonly understood that maybe 5% of cats were shedding the oocysts, but Lily's new research shows it's actually much more common.
So instead of looking under a microscope hoping that we see one of these oocysts, we're using a DNA-based technique to look for the DNA of this particular parasite. And we're finding it in 85 to 90% of the cats we look at.
So it's almost every cat. Here's what Lily says normally happens when healthy people get infected with Toxoplasma.
The parasite enters the blood. It migrates to muscles and to your brain. And it just sort of chills and hangs out there. Probably a decade ago, we thought that it was harmless, that most people had a benign infection and it didn't matter. And then we've had these recent links to behavior that we're now wondering if maybe it's not harmless, even if you don't have the full-blown disease.
Lily says that while most people don't get the full-blown disease, there are two groups of people who are high risk, those with compromised immune systems and pregnant women. There is, Lily says, a link between Toxoplasma and miscarriages. For people who are infected with Toxoplasma, the evidence suggests that the parasite is having a direct impact on how their brains are working.
Toxoplasma has been linked with increased rates of suicide. Women infected with Toxoplasma are 50% more likely to try to kill themselves, and they're twice as likely to succeed.
It's also been linked to schizophrenia.
People with schizophrenia are more likely to be infected with Toxoplasma than people without. It's been linked to increased rates of homicide. It's been linked to increased rates of traffic accidents. You're 2.5 times more likely to crash your car if you're infected with Toxoplasma.
The good news, Lily says, is that all that hype about getting diseases from your cat's litter box is not something to worry about. The bad news? It's because those parasites aren't just in cat litter. They're everywhere, even in our water and in our produce.
The number one risk factor for toxoplasmosis is actually contact with soil. It's particularly common in landscapers.
When asked if she's afraid of getting toxoplasmosis from her cat, Lily's answer is surprising.
Well, no. I have tested my cat, and she is positive. She has toxoplasma. But she's still cute and furry, and, you know, she rolls around and asks to be petted, and she's adorable. So I love her. If it's also in the soil and the water and in on your produce, if you can find it in all of these things that you can't avoid, why not enjoy a furry companion?
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1417.